Chapter 28 Glory. Lillian McLeroy came out on her front steps to water her plants and get a closer look at the commotion in Monterey Square. Ladies in hoop skirts and men in frock coats were milling around in the bright morning sun, along with blue-uniformed soldiers with muskets slung over their shoulders. Clouds of dust rose up from the street in front of Jim Williams's house, as workmen raked truckloads of dirt over Bull Street to make it look like an unpaved 19th-century road. The panorama was startling, but the eerie sense of having seen it all before sent a shiver through Mrs. McLeroy. Monterey Square this morning looked just the way it had looked 10 years before, when the movie about the assassination of Abraham Lincoln was being filmed. The movie crews were back again, with their lights and cameras and the big vans parked across the square. This time they were filming Glory, a movie about the first black regiment in the Union Army during the Civil War. Mrs. McLeroy looked toward Mercer House, half expecting to see Jim Williams drape another Nazi flag over his balcony. But Williams was not inclined to do that this time. In fact, instead of opposing the filming, he had let the filmmakers use his house. He had let them bring their equipment in and hang lace curtains in the living room to give Mercer House the look of a mansion in Boston in the mid-1860s. Earlier, Williams and the producer had sat down in his study and, over cigars and Madeira, negotiated a fee. The producer offered $10,000. Williams leaned back in his chair and smiled. 8 years ago, I shot a man who was standing right about where you are now. In a few weeks, I'll be going on trial for murder, for the fourth time, and my lawyer is a man of expensive tastes. Make it $25,000, and you have a deal. The legal wrangling over a fourth murder trial had dragged on for nearly 2 years. Sonny Seiler first asked the court to bar another trial, on the grounds that it would put Williams in double jeopardy. The motion was denied, and so was Seiler's appeal. Both Seiler and Lawton then demanded in separate motions that the court disqualify the other from further involvement in the case. Seiler, citing Lawton's concealment of evidence, said Lawton had been guilty of prosecutorial misconduct of the highest order. Lawton countered that Seiler had defended Williams in a negligent, incompetent, and unethical manner. This accusation was based largely on Lawton's contention that the young hustler friends of Hansford had been bribed by Williams and Seiler for their affidavits. There was no proof of that allegation, however, and neither of the two witnesses had ever been used in court. Both motions were denied. The fourth trial would go forward. On one issue, all parties were agreed, that it would be impossible to find a single juror in Savannah who did not already have strong opinions about the case and about the taxpayers' money being spent on it. So, on the morning the filming of Glory began at Mercer House, Sonny Seiler went into Superior Court and asked for a change of venue. He knew it would be granted this time, and prayed only that the trial would not fall into the fire of some redneck outpost after the frying pan of Savannah. In the end, the honors went to the city of Augusta. Spencer Lawton considered it a victory, cheerfully telling friends that Augusta was a cow town and that Williams would be convicted for certain. Sonny Seiler was not so sure about that. The second oldest city in Georgia, Augusta lay 130 miles upriver from Savannah on the fall line of the Appalachian Piedmont. The city's population of 50,000 was scattered about its sloping terrain in a descending hierarchy that closely followed the lay of the land. On the hill and the high ground to the north, rich families lived in fine houses and played golf at the Augusta National Golf Club, home of the annual Masters Tournament. At the foot of the hill, the city's old tree-shaded boulevards served as a commercial core and a middle-level residential zone. Farther south, the town descended into a vast, low-lying marshland of working-class houses, mobile homes, shanties, Fort Gordon Army Base, and a backwoods thoroughfare made famous by Erskine Caldwell as a symbol of rural squalor. Tobacco Road. So Augusta had its sophisticates and its cruder elements. But when the selection of jurors began, it became clear that whether they lived on the hill or in the swamp, Augustans all had one thing in common. They had never heard of Jim Williams. Reporters and television crews came up from Savannah to cover the trial, but the local media virtually ignored it. There were no big headlines in the Augusta newspapers, no news flashes interrupting television programs, no crowds overflowing the gallery. Every weekday for 2 weeks, a jury of 6 men and 6 women calmly assembled in the Richmond County Courthouse to listen and watch as the trial unfolded. They were fascinated, even titillated, and yet they remained detached. They had not lived with the Jim Williams case as people in Savannah had lived with it. Mercer House, with all its grandeur and significance, was merely a house in a photograph to them. It hadn't figured in the landscape of their daily lives. Jim Williams had not climbed the social ladder in their very midst, arousing feelings of admiration, envy, and outrage as he had done in Savannah over the last 30 years. One prospective juror gave Sonny Seiler a reason to hope that the issue of homosexuality would not be as much a negative in Augusta as it had been in Savannah. "I have no use for gays," the man admitted during jury selection, "but I don't mind it so much if they live somewhere else." By the time the fourth trial began, Sonny Seiler had worked his presentation into an act of highly polished showmanship, focusing his energies on his strongest line of attack, the incompetence of the police. When Detective Jordan took the stand and claimed that he had put bags on Danny Hansford's hands, Seiler gave him a brown paper bag and a roll of evidence tape, held out his right hand, and asked him to tape the bag over it. Seiler then paced up and down in front of the jury, waving his bagged hand in the air, leaving no doubt that if Jordan had bagged Hansford's hands, no one at the hospital could possibly have failed to notice it. Seiler ridiculed the prosecution for inconsistencies in the statements of its expert witnesses, most notably Dr. Larry Howard, director of the state crime lab. Dr. Howard had claimed at one trial that Williams could not have fired all his shots at Hansford from behind the desk. At another, he said Williams could have done it. At different times, Howard had said that Danny Hansford's chair had fallen backward, sideways, and forward. Seiler gleefully brandished a memo that showed how officials at the state crime lab had originally planned to conceal the results of the gunshot residue tests if they did not help the prosecution. "If you do want to report the results," one official wrote to another, "just let us know. The grand jury hearing is June 12th. "They all play footsie together," Seiler piped, "and it's just disgusting. They were thirsting for a conviction. They were saying to each other, 'Let's see if the residue tests cut our way. If they do, we'll use them. If they don't, we'll forget it.'" Seiler kept the jury well entertained, and by the middle of the first week, they had nicknamed him Matlock, after the lawyer played by Andy Griffith in the popular television series. That was a good sign, and Seiler knew it. Several times in his closing remarks, he moved the jurors to laughter. That was another good sign. "Jurors never laugh if they're about to send a man to prison," he said. Minerva made only one appearance at the trial, and when she did, she told Williams she felt movement in his favor.
"But listen," she said, "just in case something go wrong, be sure you put your drawers on backwards. That way you'll get a shorter sentence."
The jurors reached a verdict 15 minutes after they sat down to deliberate, but they stayed in the jury room another 45 minutes, afraid they might seem too hasty if they sent word to the judge right away. They had found Williams not guilty. Having been acquitted at last, Jim Williams could never again be tried for murder in the shooting of Danny Hansford. It was over. The worry, the dread, the expense. Because he had been found innocent of any crime in Danny Hansford's death, his insurance company would step in and settle with Hansford's mother. So that burden was lifted as well. Back at Mercer House, Williams poured himself a drink and considered his options. For the first time in 8 years, he was a free man. Mercer House was his again, no longer held as collateral for his jail bond. He could sell the house if he wanted to. It was worth over $1 million, more than 10 times what he'd paid for it. He could rid himself of the unhappy memories and buy a penthouse in New York, a townhouse in London, or a villa on the Riviera. He could live among people who did not automatically think of guns and killing and sensational murder trials every time they looked at him. William's dark eyes sparkled as he thought about the possibilities. Then a smile crossed his face. "No, I think I'll stay right here," he said. "My living in Mercer House pisses off all the right people." Chapter 29. And the Angels Sing. 6 months after his acquittal, Jim Williams sat down at his desk to make plans for his first Christmas party in 8 years. He called Lucille Wright and asked her to prepare a low-country banquet for 200 people. He hired a bartender, 4 waiters, and 2 musicians. Then, he took out his stack of index cards and embarked on the most delicate and satisfying task of all, compiling his guest list. Williams considered each card carefully before consigning it to the in-stack or the out-stack. He put most of the regulars promptly on the in-stack, the Yearleys, the Richardsons, the Blunns, the Strongs, the Crams, the McLeans, the Minuses, the Hartridges, and the Haineses. But he hesitated when he came to the card of his old friend Millicent Morland. Though she had been steadfast in her belief that Williams was innocent, she had made the grievous mistake of not attending his last party, on the grounds that it had come too soon after Danny Hansford's death. For this transgression, Williams now put her on the outstack. She would do penance this year. She would be chastened, and then she would be restored to grace next Christmas, assuming she did nothing to displease Williams before then. As for Lee and Emma Adler, Williams simply dropped their card into the wastebasket. Williams had no need to curry favor with the Adlers anymore. Lee Adler had been up to his old tricks anyway. He had just returned from the White House, where he had received a National Medal of Arts award and posed for photographs with President and Mrs. Bush. This only made him more hateful to Williams, and to most of the people who would be attending his party. On top of that, Adler had become embroiled in a bitter fight locally over his plan to build new Victorian-style housing for blacks in downtown Savannah. Adler's scheme called for row upon row of identical houses, covered with vinyl siding, and jammed together with no lawns or green spaces in between. The historic Savannah Foundation had risen up in angry opposition, decrying the substandard quality of Adler's proposed dwellings. Adler had been forced to redesign the project, putting in green spaces and replacing vinyl siding with wood. Jim Williams knew that his guests at his Christmas party would be eager to exchange views about Lee Adler's latest activities without fear of being overheard by either him or Emma. No problem. They would not be there. Williams also dropped Serena Dawes's card into the wastebasket, but sadly, and for a different reason. Some months earlier, Serena had decided that the 1930s and 1940s, the days of her glamorous full-page ads in Life magazine, had been the high point of her life, and that it would be downhill from here on. She announced that she would die on her birthday, and she thereupon refused to leave the house, or receive visitors, or eat. After several weeks, she was taken to the hospital, where one night she summoned her doctor and nurses and thanked them graciously for looking after her. By morning, she was dead. She had not died of starvation or committed suicide by any conventional means. She had simply willed herself to die, and, being a strong-willed woman, she had succeeded. She had missed dying on her birthday by 2 days. Serena's death was not related in any way to the end of her affair with Luther Driggers, but Williams paused when he came to Driggers' card anyway. Luther Driggers had been the focus of much attention in recent months. He had been struck by lightning. It had happened at the height of one of Savannah's typical summer afternoon thunderstorms. Driggers had been lying in bed with his new girlfriend, Barbara, when a wiry tongue of fire licked out from the charcoal-gray sky and enveloped his house. Barbara's hair suddenly stood on end. The first thought that ran through Driggers' head was that he had never had that kind of effect on a woman before. But then he smelled ozone in the air, and knew it meant they were surrounded by a huge electrical charge. "Get down!" he yelled. Then it struck. Luther was thrown to the floor, and Barbara was knocked unconscious for several minutes. Later, when the power was restored, they discovered that the lightning had melted the innards of the television set. At first, Driggers didn't connect the lightning with his subsequent episodes of dizziness and an increasing tendency to fall downstairs and lose his balance in the shower. He had been drunk most of his life, and those things seemed attributable to liquor. But when he stopped drinking, the dizziness continued. Doctors found and removed from his brain a semi-fluid mass the size of a golf ball and the consistency of motor oil. In the months that followed, Barbara's stomach began to swell, and that did seem to be a direct consequence of the events of that tempestuous afternoon. They decided that if the baby was a boy, they'd name it Thor, after the Norse god of thunder. If it was a girl, they'd name it Athena, after the Greek goddess who carried Zeus's thunderbolt. But Barbara wasn't pregnant after all. The lightning had damaged her internal organs, much as it had done to the television set, and within months she became sick and died. Driggers, though otherwise healthy, once again took to walking out of Clary's drugstore without eating his breakfast. The old fears about his demons resurfaced, and once again people spoke darkly about the possibility that he might dump his bottle of poison into Savannah's water supply. "Anyone who believes that is a fool," Driggers told me one morning in Clary's. "Because you wouldn't dream of doing it, would you?" I said. "Oh, I might very well do it," he said, "if I could. Unfortunately, it's not possible. Do you remember what I told you the day I first met you? That Savannah's water came out of a limestone aquifer? And that that was the reason why your toilet bowl was encrusted with crystallized scum? Well, for the same reason that Savannah's water comes from an aquifer deep in the earth, I couldn't poison it if I wanted to. I couldn't get to it. Now, if there were an above-ground reservoir, I could dump poison in it very easily. But there isn't."
"I'm relieved to hear that," I said.
"Don't be too relieved," Driggers replied. "With all the industrial pumping going on, salt water has already begun to seep into the aquifer, and it'll soon be unusable. Then we'll have to drink the filthy water from the Savannah River, and my poison couldn't make that water any worse than it already is." Jim Williams held Driggers' card between his thumb and forefinger, imperiously weighing the pros and cons. Luther Driggers was a friend of long standing, but Williams recalled how Driggers had ridiculed him for not being clever enough to dispose of Danny Hansford's body before the police had come, implying that Williams had been guilty of murder and therefore should have removed the evidence. Driggers' card went onto the outstack. Williams hesitated again when he came to the card of Joe Odom. Joe had first made it onto Williams's guest list upon his marriage to his third wife, Mary Adams, whose father happened to be chairman of the board of the CNS Bank. That marriage had catapulted Joe into Savannah's highest social circles. By the time of his divorce, he had become such a popular figure in his own right that Williams continued to invite him to his parties despite his increasing financial embarrassments. Lately, however, Joe Odom's fortunes had taken a precipitous plunge. In July, the landlord of Sweet Georgia Brown's had padlocked the bar, evicted Joe for non-payment of rent, and sued for arrears. Joe filed for bankruptcy. Mandy, who had lost more than $5,000 in the collapse of the bar, took her losses in stride, until she happened to overhear Joe referring to another woman as my fourth wife in waiting. With that, she stomped out of the Hamilton Turner house, swearing vengeance. Her revenge took a particularly devastating form, as Joe learned when he looked at his newspaper one November morning and saw the headline, Attorney Joe Odom Indicted for Forgery. According to the article, Joe had been charged with 7 counts of faking the signature of Mandy Nichols, his partner in the now-defunct jazz bar, Sweet Georgia Brown's. The 7 checks totaled $1,193.42. Forgery was a felony offense, punishable by up to 10 years in jail. Joe knew at once what Mandy had done. She had sifted through the canceled checks from the Sweet Georgia Brown's checking account, the account they had put in Mandy's name, because Joe's name had been anathema to every bank in Savannah, and she had picked out 7 checks that Joe had signed in her absence. Joe stood in his front hall, newspaper in hand, absorbing the enormity of the crisis before him. It dawned on him that the sheriff would soon be arriving with a warrant for his arrest. So he pulled on a shirt and a pair of pants, climbed out a rear window, jumped into his van, and headed south on I-95. He had no intention of spending the weekend with sheriffs, bail bondsmen, and lawyers. Not this weekend, anyway. The Georgia-Florida football game was on Saturday, and Joe would definitely be there. Nothing took precedence over the Georgia-Florida game. Ever. Not even a felony indictment. The sheriff can wait, Joe said when he called friends from Jacksonville to inform them of his whereabouts. I'll be back on Monday. Upon his return, Joe appeared in federal court and told the judge that the 7 checks were not really forgeries, but rather an unorthodox way of doing business. He pointed out that 1 check had been made out to the linen service, another to the phone company, and another to the plumber, all to pay legitimate expenses for his and Mandy's business. He produced deposit slips showing that he had put more money into the account than he had taken out with the 7 checks. He concluded by saying that if he had really intended to commit forgery, he would have taken more than $1,193.42. But forgery was forgery, regardless of the amount. Furthermore, Joe couldn't quite explain why the 2 largest checks had been made out to cash. In the end, he had no choice but to plead guilty. The judge sentenced him to 2 years probation, stipulating that as a first offender, he could wipe his record clean if he made restitution within a year. If he didn't, he would go to prison for the remainder of his term. Jim Williams put Joe's cards squarely on the inn stack. Yes, indeed. Joe Odom would be the man on the spot for a change, the man on the receiving end of the opprobrious glances. Joe would take it all very much in stride. Williams admired that about him, his resilience. Despite his mounting problems, Joe was still the gregarious, table-hopping, good-natured man about town. In fact, it was Joe Odom's smiling face that first caught my eye when I arrived at the party.
"Well, it looks like you'll have a happy ending for your book," he said. "I mean, just look around you. Jim Williams isn't a convicted murderer anymore, and I won't be a convicted forger, just as soon as I pay Mandy the $1,193.42 I don't really owe her. We're all out of jail, and it's party time again. If that isn't happiness, what is? I was mulling over Joe Odom's formula for happiness when Minerva appeared before me in a black-and-white maid's uniform. She was carrying a tray of champagne glasses. Guests gathered around and helped themselves, and when the tray was empty, Minerva moved closer to me.
"I need to get me some devil's shoestring," she said under her breath.
"What's that?" I asked.
"It's a root. Some people calls it the devil root. I calls it my baby, 'cause it works good for me. I didn't bring none with me, though, and I need some before midnight. Trouble's brewing. It's that boy again."
"Danny Hansford?"
"Uh-huh. He's still working against Mr. Jim."
"But what can he do now?" I asked. "Jim Williams has been acquitted. He can't ever be tried again for killing Danny."
"There's plenty that boy can do," Minerva said. "He don't need no murder trial to cause hell. The boy died hating Mr. Jim, and that's the meanest kind of curse you can have against you. It's the hardest one to get undone."
Minerva's eyes narrowed.
"Now listen," she said.
"I
need to get me some of that root, and I know where there's some growing. It ain't but 2-3 miles from here. Mr. Jim can't take me there on account of this party going on. So what I need to know is, will you drive me?"
I nodded that I would, and Minerva told me to meet her in the square, by the monument, at 11. If the angry ghost of Danny Hansford was hanging heavy over Jim Williams's party, it didn't dampen the mood even slightly. Sonny Seiler was present, rosy-cheeked and smiling, accepting congratulations for his acquittal of Williams and condolences for the recent death of Ugga Four, who had been felled by kidney failure at home while watching a Georgia basketball game on television. The bulldog mascot was buried in a private funeral service near Gate 10 of Sanford Stadium, alongside the graves of Ugga 1, Ugga 2, and Ugga 3. Seiler chose a successor, and within 2 weeks, the state of Georgia sent him a new license plate for his red station wagon. Ugga 5. Blanche Williams, who had been the soul of stoicism throughout her son's ordeal, wore an evening gown and a pink corsage. She pronounced herself as pleased as she could be. She was 83, she said, and, now that her son was safe, the good Lord could take her any time he pleased. Jim Williams was decked out in black tie and Fabergé cufflinks. He circulated among his guests, laughing heartily and displaying an ease and contentedness he hadn't shown in many years. He raised his eyebrows slightly when I told him I had agreed to take Minerva on an errand later on.
"I think she's going a little bit overboard this time," he said, "and I told her so. I'm afraid she may be getting too fond of the $25 I pay her each time she does a little root working for me, but it doesn't matter. She'll never cost me a fraction of what I've had to pay my lawyers."
At 11 o'clock, Minerva and I got into my car, and in a few minutes we were heading west on the road toward the airport.
"It's growing wild just this side of an overpass," she said, "but I don't remember which overpass."
We pulled off the road at the Lines Parkway overpass. Minerva took a flashlight out of her satchel and thrashed around in the brush. She came back empty-handed. She had no luck at the second overpass either. At the third, she foraged farther afield and returned carrying a handful of weeds and roots.
"We got the roots," she said, "but we ain't through yet. Now we got to go see the head man."
"Dr. Buzzard?" I asked.
I was beginning to suspect I had been duped into taking part in a long and involved expedition. Dr. Buzzard's grave was in Beaufort, an hour's drive each way.
"No, not him," she said. "He done all he's gonna do. We gonna see the real head man now, the only one who can put a stop to this thing."
She didn't elaborate, and in moments we were riding east toward the beach, open fields and marsh grass spreading out into the darkness on all sides. "Jim Williams doesn't seem as worried as you do about Danny Hansford," I said. The oncoming headlights glinted off Minerva's purple lenses.
"He is worried," she said softly. "And he should be. 'Cause I know, and he know, and the boy know, that justice ain't been done yet."
She stared ahead, unblinking, and spoke as if in a trance.
"Mr. Jim haven't told me nothing," she said. "He didn't need to. I seen it in his face. I heard it in his voice. When people talks to me, I don't hear the voice. I see a picture. And when Mr. Jim spoke, I saw it all. The boy fussed at him that night. Mr. Jim got angry and shot him. He lied to me, and he lied to the court. But I helped him anyway, 'cause he didn't mean to kill the boy. I do feel sorry for the boy, but I always takes the side of the living, no matter what they done."
We crossed a low bridge over the inland waterway onto Oatland Island. After taking several turns, we came to a boat ramp that led down to the edge of a wide creek. "Do you want me to wait here?" I asked.
"No, you can come too," she said, "but only if you keep real quiet."
We left the car and walked down the ramp. The air was still, except for the sound of a small motorboat somewhere out in the middle of the creek. Minerva looked into the darkness and waited. It was the night of the new moon, she said, which was why it was so dark. She said new moon nights were the best nights to do her kind of work.
"Before I left my house tonight," she said, "I fed the witches. That's what you got to do when you're having trouble with evil spirits. You got to feed the witches before you do anything else."
"How do you do that?" I asked. "What do witches eat?"
"Witches loves pork meat," she said. "They loves rice and potatoes. They loves black-eyed peas and cornbread. Lima beans, too, and collard greens and cabbage all cooked in pork fat. Witches is old folks, most of them. They don't care none for low-cal. You pile that food on a paper plate, stick a plastic fork in it, and set it down by the side of a tree, and that feeds the witches."
The motorboat's engine clicked off. An oar splashed in the water.
"That you, Jasper?"
Minerva called.
"Uh-huh,"
a low voice answered. A shadowy form was taking shape 20 yards offshore. It was an old black man in a slouch hat. He was paddling a small wooden boat. Minerva nudged me.
"He ain't the head man," she whispered. "He's just taken us to him."
Jasper touched his hat as we got in, then pushed off with the paddle and started up the motor again. As we moved into the blackness, Minerva dipped her handful of roots into the water to clean off the dirt. She broke off a piece and put it in her mouth. The boat rode low in the water. I sat perfectly still, afraid that if I made the slightest movement, we might capsize. A solid wall of trees rose before us on the opposite shore. It was a forbidding black mass without a single light visible. Jasper turned off the engine and paddled until the boat scraped the sand. We all got out. Jasper pulled the boat onto the shore and sat down to wait. Minerva and I climbed to the top of a low rise. Slowly, as my eyes adjusted to the darkness, I became aware of dense shrubbery around us and of the ghostly drapery of Spanish moss. We moved deeper into the trees, and I began to make out solid shapes rising from the ground. Obelisks, columns, arches. We were in Bonaventure Cemetery. I had come to this place many times since Mary Hardy had brought me here on my first day in Savannah, but never after dark. I recalled now what Miss Hardy had told me, that late at night, if you listened closely, you could hear echoes of that long-ago dinner party, with the burning house and the guests proposing toasts and throwing their wine glasses against a tree trunk. All I heard tonight was the wind sighing through the trees. Then it occurred to me why I had never come here this late. The cemetery shut its gates at dusk. We were trespassing. "I don't think we're supposed to be here now, Minerva," I said. "The cemetery's closed."
"Can't do nothing about that," she said. "Dead time don't change for nobody."
"But what if they have a night watchman?" I asked.
"I has worked this flower garden many times and never had no trouble," Minerva said firmly. "The spirits is on our side. They'll watch over us."
She shined her flashlight on a piece of paper with a hand-drawn map on it. "What if they have guard dogs?" I said. Minerva looked up from her map.
"Now listen," she said. "If you're afraid to come with me, you can go back and wait with Jasper. But make up your mind, 'cause it's already 20 till midnight.
In truth, I was beginning to feel the protective force of Minerva and her spirits. So I followed as she set off, map and flashlight in hand, mumbling to herself. Bonaventure at night was a vast and somber place, nothing like the friendly little graveyard in Beaufort where Dr. Buzzard was buried, and where boys played basketball on a floodlit court 100 yards away. Before long, we came upon a somewhat more open terrain, with a few scattered trees and modest tombstones in orderly rows. Minerva paced off several rows and turned right. Halfway down the row, she stopped and looked again at her map. Then she turned and shined the light on the ground behind her.
"There it is," she said.
At first, I saw nothing. No headstone, no tomb. But when I stepped closer, I noticed a small granite tile set into the ground, flush with the sandy soil. The beam of Minerva's flashlight illuminated the inscription. "Danny Lewis Hansford, March 1st, 1960, May 2nd, 1981.
"That's him," she said. "That's the head man in this thing. He's the one that's causing all the trouble."
Deep double tire tracks bracketed Danny Hansford's marker. Utility trucks had apparently driven back and forth over his grave. There was even a spot of crankcase oil on the gravestone. It made a silent mockery of Danny's boast that he'd get a big tombstone if he died in Mercer House. Minerva knelt in front of the marker and gently wiped away the loose sand.
"Pitiful, ain't it?"
she said.
"Now I know why he haven't let go. He ain't happy here. He got a nice oak tree and a dogwood overhead, but he ain't happy."
She dug a small hole next to the grave and slipped a piece of root into it. Then she reached into her shopping bag and took out a half-pint bottle of wild turkey. She poured a few drops into the hole, then put the bottle to her lips and drank the rest.
You can drink all you want to when you're at the grave of a person who loved to drink,
she said.
You'll never get drunk, 'cause the dead will take the fumes away from you. By the time you pull the top off the bottle, they done beat you to it. You can drink for hours. Mr. Jim told me the boy loved wild turkey, so I give him a little drink to get him in a better mood. Me, I like to dip snuff. When I die, you can carry me my favorite snuff, peach or honeybee. Put it under your lower lip when you sit by my grave.
Minerva seemed to be in a better mood herself. She dumped the contents of her shopping bag on the ground and motioned for me to step back and give her room. Then she began to speak in that faraway voice.
Where they got you now, boy? Has they got you in heaven? If you ain't in heaven yet, you wanna get there, don't ya? 'Cause face it, boy, you gonna be dead a long time. So now listen. The only way you gonna move up is if you quit playing with Mr. Jim.
Minerva leaned to within a few inches of the gravestone, as if whispering into Danny's ear.
I can help you, boy. I got connections. I has influence. I knows the dead. I will call on them and tell them to lift you up. Who else gonna do that for you? Nobody. Do you hear me, boy?
She cocked an ear to the grave.
I think I'm hearing something,
she said,
but I ain't sure what it is.
Minerva's hopeful expression slowly turned into a scowl.
Sounds like laughing. Damn it, it is laughing. He just laughing up a storm at me, that's what he's doing.
Minerva gathered her paraphernalia and stuffed it angrily back into her bag.
Damn it, boy, you ain't no better than my old man. I swear you won't get no help from me.
She rose to her feet and headed down the row of tombstones, lurching and muttering.
You think you had a hard life, boy? Hell, you ain't got no idea. You never had no bills to pay, no kids to feed, no house to clean. You done had it easy. Well, you can just lay there now. That'll teach you.
Minerva charged through the darkness, the beam of her flashlight bouncing ahead of her. We passed the graves of Bonaventure's two most famous residents, Johnny Mercer and Conrad Aiken, Mercer's epitaph affirming a hereafter in which angels sing, Aiken's raising the specter of doubt and of destinations unknown. Danny Hansford would have to chart his own course now. Minerva had washed her hands of him, at least for the time being. Once we were back in the boat, she lightened up.
I'll leave him lay there for a while,
she said.
Let him worry he missed his chance to get raised up into heaven. Next time I come, he'll be glad to see me. I'll carry him some wild turkey and some devil's shoestring, and I'll give him another chance. Oh, he'll back off Mr. Jim by and by, uh-huh. Then I'll raise him up, and he won't laugh at me no more. You wait and see. Him and me is going to be such good friends, he'll be giving me numbers before long so I can play 'em and get me some money.
Less than a month later, on the morning of January 14th, 1990, Jim Williams came downstairs to feed the cat and make himself a cup of tea. After doing that, but before picking up the newspaper from the front stoop, he collapsed and died. News of Williams's sudden death at the age of 59 immediately gave rise to speculation that he had been murdered or that he had taken an overdose of drugs. But the coroner announced that there had been no indication of foul play or drug abuse, and that Williams appeared to have died of natural causes, most likely a heart attack. After an autopsy, The coroner was more specific. Williams had died of pneumonia. This started another rumor, that he might have died of AIDS. But Williams had shown no signs of being ill. In fact, only a few hours before dying, he had attended a party, where he had been in good spirits and in apparent good health. Minerva, of course, had her own idea about what had happened.
"It was the boy that done it," she said.
A little noticed detail of Williams's death lent an eerie ring of truth to her pronouncement. Williams had died in his study, in the same room where he had shot Danny Hansford. He had been found lying on the carpet behind the desk, in the very spot where he would have fallen 8 years earlier, if Danny Hansford had actually fired a gun and the shots had found their mark. Chapter 30. Afterward. 2 days after Williams's funeral, I paid my respects to his mother and sister at Mercer House. As I was leaving, a horse and carriage came clopping around the square and slowed to a stop in front of the house. From the sidewalk, I could hear the tour guide telling her three passengers that General Hugh Mercer had built the house during the Civil War, that the songwriter Johnny Mercer had grown up in it, and that Jacqueline Onassis had once offered to buy it for $2 million. To this by now familiar routine, the tour guide added that filmmakers had used the house the previous spring to shoot scenes for the movie Glory. But she said nothing about Jim Williams, or Danny Hansford, or the sensational murder case that had captivated the city for so long. The tourists would leave Savannah in a few hours, enchanted by the elegance of this romantic garden city, but none the wiser about the secrets that lay within the innermost glades of its secluded bower. I, too, had become enchanted by Savannah. But after having lived there for 8 years, off and on, I had come to understand something of its self-imposed estrangement from the outside world. Pride was part of it. Indifference was, too. And so was arrogance. But underneath all that, Savannah had only one motive, to preserve a way of life it believed to be under siege from all sides. It was for this reason that Savannah had discouraged Prudential from establishing its regional headquarters in the city in the 1950s, and why Prudential ended up in Jacksonville instead. It was why Savannah had given Giancarlo Menotti's Spoleto USA Festival the cold shoulder in the 1970s, and why the festival finally settled in Charleston. Savannah wasn't much interested in what went on outside Savannah. It had little enthusiasm for the popular culture, as headline entertainers like Eric Clapton, Sting, George Carlin, and Gladys Knight and the Pips discovered when they brought their acts to Savannah and found themselves playing to half-empty auditoriums. Savannah spurned all suitors, urban developers with grandiose plans, and individuals, the Gucci carpetbaggers, as Mary Hardy called them, who moved to Savannah and immediately began suggesting ways of improving the place. Savannah resisted every one of them as if they had been General William Tecumseh Sherman all over again. Sometimes that meant throwing up bureaucratic roadblocks. At other times, it meant telling tourists only what was good for them to know. Savannah was invariably gracious to strangers, but it was immune to their charms. It wanted nothing so much as to be left alone. Time and again, I was reminded of what Mary Hardy had told me on my first day in town. "We happen to like things just the way they are." I had no idea how deeply that sentiment ran, until a revealing incident occurred late in my stay. The Chamber of Commerce had hired an outside team of urban consultants to study Savannah's economic and social problems. When the consultants submitted their final report, they appended a note saying that in the course of their research, they had asked 20 prominent Savannians where they thought the city should be in the next 5, 10, and 15 years. None of them had ever given the matter any thought. For me, Savannah's resistance to change was its saving grace. The city looked inward, sealed off from the noises and distractions of the world at large. It grew inward, too, and in such a way that its people flourished like hothouse plants tended by an indulgent gardener. The ordinary became extraordinary. Eccentrics thrived. Every nuance and quirk of personality achieved greater brilliance in that lush enclosure than would have been possible anywhere else in the world.
And now, John Berendt discussing Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil and the City and People of Savannah.
I gave the finished manuscript to my agent, who was a very good agent, very well known, and she read it and she thought it was most enjoyable, but that it was too local, that a publisher wouldn't take a chance. No publisher would take a chance on it, and she gave it back to me. I thereupon found another agent who felt otherwise, and within a week she had 4 major publishers bidding for it, and Random House bought it. And this book, which was supposed by the first agent to be too local, is now published in 12 foreign languages, including Norwegian and Greek and Japanese and German and Italian, French, etc. And perhaps more to come. It will be made into a movie by Warner Brothers. It has sold nearly 1 million copies in hardcover in the United States, and it is, if anything, it's not a too local book. Random House published the book in January 1994, and they began to notice almost immediately that word was spreading about it. Word of mouth carried the book onto the bestseller list about 6 weeks later. And popularity grew, and suddenly Savannah began to notice an influx of tourism, a huge influx. It was spring of 1994. The numbers were way above any other tourist numbers they'd ever had before. And so eventually, the state looked into it, Georgia looked into it, and discovered that tourism was up by October by 46%. And now, 2 years later, the number, I think, has doubled. They say that the tourism's doubled, which means that Savannah now is, quote, on the map. It always deserved to be on the map, but it had never quite made it onto the map. People discover in reading the book that it's a fascinating, seductive, beautiful city with a lovely atmosphere. And what I find people saying most often after reading the book is, gee, I want to go to Savannah. I want to see it. And the numbers bear that out. Savannah's done quite well. As I mentioned in the book, Savannah likes to be apart from the rest of the country. They love their isolation. So I'm often asked, have you ruined Savannah? You know. And the response is, thank goodness, no, I haven't. Because what happens when tourists come is they leave some money behind and go home. They don't stick around and ruin the city. Savannah is impervious to that kind of result because they do not allow the big, noisy tour buses to go into the squares, the 21 beautiful squares. They have to park, and the tourists get out and walk into the square. So you don't have big, noisy engines churning the whole time, keeping the air conditioning going that you might have in some other city. So Savannah has survived this onslaught of tourists. It's still a charming, small city. Some reviewers mentioned that this was a love letter to Savannah. It's about a murder. It's about very strange people. But it's very funny. And there is a lovely quality to the atmosphere that you see in, while reading the books. So I think that's what drew people. And my descriptions of the physical beauty of Savannah certainly had something to do with it. Savannah's a historic town. It's just that, and people, everyone knows the name, Savannah, but people really hadn't been there in any great numbers. And it's within reach. You can go there from anywhere in the country. So it sounded like a perfect weekend getaway. After all, that's how I first experienced it. So I think that's what drew people. I mean, there might be other factors as well. But, it sounds like a nice place to go and have a look. This is a story about universal characters, I guess, or people, characters who can be appreciated anywhere. You don't have to. In fact, when I was in Savannah, people in Savannah would say to me, who would ever want to read a book about Savannah? We'll read it, they said, but we don't think anybody else will. And I said, well, you're wrong there, because I'm not writing it for you. I'm writing it. It would be foolish of me to write a book for Savannians. There aren't that many of you. But I'm writing it for people who have never been to Savannah. In my mind, constantly, is the reader who has never set foot here. So it's going to be comprehensible and enjoyable for someone who has never been here, doesn't know what you all look like. And that was always in my mind, and that's the way it's turned out. People who haven't been there can see pictures in their mind from the book and are enchanted, as I was. I was very fortunate in stumbling on this magical city that has incredible real-life characters in it. You don't often get that lucky. There are three major characters here that any novelist would have been happy to make up: Chablis, Jim Williams, and Joe Odom, plus a lot of minor characters. Why, you might wonder, are there so many delicious characters in Savannah, in such a small place? I think it's because gossip is so important. And what I mean is this. People in Savannah gossip more than anything else. And what do people gossip about? Other people's behavior. The stranger the behavior, the better the gossip. The better the gossip, the more you appreciate the person you're gossiping about. The person who is eccentric or behaves strangely knows he is being gossiped about and knows he is appreciated and therefore is encouraged to outdo himself in strangeness. This does not happen everywhere else. Part of the reason, of course, is that it's a small town, and everyone knows everybody, so gossip is much more intense. But if you were to behave strangely in, let us say, Indianapolis, people would shun you. They would regard you with suspicion. But in Savannah, you are cherished because you give them something to talk about. Emma Kelly, the Lady of 6,000 Songs, is in great demand, and so is the Lady Chablis. Now, they're both performers to begin with, but the Lady Chablis was not known by very many people. Now, wherever I go in the world, people want to know about Chablis. In Australia, they want to know about Chablis. They want to know about her in Norway and in Italy. So she's very famous, and Emma Kelly and Chablis both came to New York in June of 1995. The New York Jazz Festival put on a concert in Lincoln Center called Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. It was a lot of Johnny Mercer's songs, and Jerry Mulligan played the saxophone, and Bobby Short sang, and Margaret Whiting sang, and a lot of others. It was a marvelous concert, and there were some readings from the book. I did four very short ones, and Carrie Nye, the actress, did one. Marion Seldes, the actress, did one. And Chablis came and did one, and she brought the house down. And Emma Kelly sang a medley of Johnny Mercer's songs as well. So they're very famous, and they're taking it very well, I think, and I'm delighted for their sake. There have been book signings in Savannah to which eight or nine characters in the book, some people only appear on one page. They also were at this book signing. I wasn't present, but they all were, and it was marvelous. It went on for about 6 hours, I'm told, all of them signing the books. People in Savannah will say to other people, I'm on page 43, I'm on page 65, and they're very proud of that. One of the compelling factors, I think, with this book is that it is true. And if it had just been the product of my fertile imagination, people would say, oh, you're very imaginative, it's a delightful book. But since it's real, it's that much more astonishing. And that's another reason people want to go to Savannah, because they think they'll see people like this. If not the people in the book, they'll see others just as eccentric and bizarre. Since it's real, the reaction has been redoubled, you see. I'm very well received in Savannah now. I go there frequently. I don't have an apartment anymore. But I go there, usually it's once, at least in every 2 months period, for some reason, whether it's to do an interview or to take a TV crew on a tour of Savannah. I go there frequently, and people are as nice as they could be. If they see me walking on the street, they stop their car or lean out of the window and say, hi, you want to ride? Mr. Barron, love your book. It's very nice to go to Savannah for me now, because there may be people who grouse about the book. I'm sure there are. It's inevitable. But they don't do it to my face. They're far too polite. So they steel themselves. They're lovely to me. And they talk about the book constantly. I was invited to give yet another speech in Savannah not long ago, and I said, aren't you people tired of this yet? And they said, no, no, no. I never had any trouble. I never had anybody get very angry. I mean, one or two characters, Lee Adler, for instance, was not happy at first, but he's come around to thinking that it wasn't so terrible. And at first he wouldn't talk to me. Now, then he took my hand and said, listen, it's been great for Savannah. It's made me famous. But there, I don't sense any animosity at all. When I started out, I knew